Capital Investment Committee hearing for March 5th is called to order. Quorum is present. Chair Lee may have a motion to approve the minutes for March 3rd, 2026. Chair Lee moves approval of the minutes for March 3rd, 2026. Any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. The motion prevails and the minutes for March 3rd are approved. Good morning, members. Today we have a pretty jam-packed agenda as we continue our way through the state agency bonding presentations. As everyone can see, we're going to start with a pretty fun presentation with the Minnesota Zoo, whose infrastructure's needs we were able to view firsthand during the fall bonding tours. Welcome to the committee, Director Falway and Dr. Rivas. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Yes, committee chairs, committee members, John Frawley, Director of the Minnesota Zoo.
And I'm Annie Rivas. I'm the Director of Animal Health, or Head Veterinarian at the Minnesota Zoo.
And I'd also like to introduce Jen and Alex, who are Ambassador Animal Interpreters here at the Minnesota Zoo, and we have with us Aspen. So we're going to let our interpreters kind of give you a little overview of one of the important animals at the zoo.
Thank you. Yes, I'm Alexandria Tosser, I'm an Ambassador Animal staff members, along with Jen here. And this is the star of the show right here. This is Aspen. She is a North American porcupine, so a Minnesota native here. And one you can see up at our treetop trail. You get to meet her every day. We have demos for our guests that come to visit us. And she is quite the native, as you can see. She's really captivating here. Now let's just clear the air here. She cannot shoot out her quills, which is why we're able to come here today. Those quills are a famous part of her hair, but she has three types of hair. Where we have just one, she's got three. So these white ones that are sticking out here are actually her guard hair. So think of them as like her whiskers and her feelers, since they're a nocturnal animal. Underneath there, where she deceivingly looks very fluffy, she has all that under fur. So think of it as like her built-in long underwear keeps her nice and warm. And then underneath that are those famous quills. And there are 30,000 of them on her body. You'll notice she's kind of hunched over as she walks, and that's A-OK for a porcupine, totally natural. And that's because she has no quills on her underside right here. So she always wants to protect that unquilled side there. So right now she's pretty relaxed. That's her job at the zoo, is she was both hand-reared by staff so that she's very comfortable around people, so those quills are kind of relaxed. But if something were to come after her at the zoo, she's pretty safe. She doesn't have to worry about it. She can actually make those quills stand straight up. When they're in this position, they can easily be detached if somebody actually has to make contact with them. So those cartoons are fun that we watch as children, but totally we're going to myth bust that. She can't shoot out those quills at all. Sure, they'll fall out if she shakes, and she might do a little shake today, just like dogs or cattle, and sometimes those quills might fall out, but she cannot shoot them, and why she makes such a great ambassador. And also one of the animals, of all the thousands of animals that live at the zoo, that really depends on our animal health building, which we're going to be talking about today. We work very closely with our vet team all the time, monitoring. Making sure she's healthy, not only with her diet, her nutrition, her behavior, and also when we want to try to breed a North American porcupine. So we need all of those updated facilities to help us to do that so we can continue having amazing animals like this here at the zoo. Now, her name is Aspen because, you know, it's one of the trees you find them in here in Minnesota, and actually one of her favorite types of food that she will get when she browses up on leaves. They're naturally a browser, so she is a complete herbivore. Likes to eat nature's buffet of whatever she can find up in the trees, leaves, air bark there that they'll chew on. They have these amazing teeth. Did you know this is the second largest rodent in Minnesota, just behind another animal we have at the zoo, the beaver. So this is a really large one. She's weighing in just under about probably 20 pounds, which is a good size for her, but you'll find a whole variety of porcupines in different sizes, just like humans come in different sizes too. But this is a good size for her as well, and then a really fun animal for our guests to meet. Look at that. This is her station at her table, right? So we try to keep our communication really clear with our animals when we are working with them so that they know what the expectation is and why she's done so good in a whole new habitat for today at the Capital Meeting Committee members. So we'll open it up and take a couple of questions about Aspen. If there's something you'd like to ask about her, we're happy to share that with you. And she is naturally, if you're wondering, how is she doing this table here? They're naturally arboreal, so they spend their time in trees. So she knows what the edges here of the table are, and that's how we can get her to just kind of gently mosey and walk along here. You'll notice that they hand her food. She's using those claws.
Those claws are amazing adaptations. They are not sharp, but they're extremely strong, and they help her to climb. They are not nimble climbers like you'd see like squirrels in trees. They actually rely on your muscle strength and those claws as they navigate. And then that famous tail down here is more like a paddle that they use, much more like you would for like a nuthatch or woodpeckers as they climb. So she can climb straight up trees. Isn't that amazing? And go straight down trees. So completely made for our Minnesota habitat. All right, any questions that you're wondering about Aspen? Yes, thank you.
I think Representative Carroll was up first.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair, Vice Chair, Co-Chair, whatever. Chair, some sort of chair. I think you already answered it, but the quills are not poisonous, correct?
You are correct. The quills are not poisonous. They are pointy. They can be very irritating when they go in. They only go in one way, and they do not work themselves out that way. So they've got to usually because where they go in, it can be devastating to other animals. So other animals learn very quickly, I smell an animal like this or see an animal like this, stay away. You know, and it's a great way to protect themselves. They're a little barbed all around the whole tips of those quills there.
Thank you.
You're very welcome.
Representative Scraba.
Thank you, Chair. Frederick, what's its natural enemy?
There are a couple when they're younger. Sometimes our larger cats, like a bobcat perhaps, puma, and or even great horned owls, when they can sneak up on them. When they're small little porky pets, they can just be about this big. They're really, really tiny. However, when they get this fully sized grown, they don't really have very many, which is great because as you can tell, she's not really fast. Figure out a way to hunt after these animals and get to that soft undercoming without getting quilled. So very good. Somebody's got to eat porcupines, and the fisher can do it effectively. But no worries, their population numbers are okay here.
Yes, exactly. Those trends. Great question. Any other questions about this amazing animal here?
I think we can continue with the presentation.
All right.
Great. All right. Thank you very much.
All right.
Thank you. She's really enjoying her time out, but you'll see how she's been trained to self-crate, which also helps us when we're taking her around the zoo and other places where she has that choice of deciding. So thank you very much.
Thanks, Al. Co-chairs, committee members, I'll go on with the presentation while they load up Aspen here. We're used to working around animals. Just a reminder about your Minnesota Zoo. It's a state zoo. Has an economic engine that drives over $320 million of annual impact in the state. The Minnesota Zoo is a beloved zoo. It's Minnesota's top year-round gated attraction, reaching between 1.4 and 1.5 million visitors per year. So people are using the zoo more than ever. We are a unique state agency as we get about one-third of our funding from the state. Two-thirds, we have to have a strong business plan. With revenue and food and events. So we're very proud of the business plan and how we run the zoo. We are one of the largest environmental destination educators in Minnesota, reaching almost 100,000 students from over 1,000 schools. We have programs that reach underserved communities called Free to Explore. So if you qualify for general assistance in the state of Minnesota, you come to the zoo for free. That program's growing up to over 130,000 people per year are coming to our Free to Explore program, and from all 87 counties, we do zip codes, so we record that. And then we have an amazing reputation. We're an AZA accredited facility, but we are known throughout the country for our conservation education and just overall large experience. We're the fifth largest zoo in the country. With that said, you know, as a director, I hear a lot of times people still refer to the zoo as the new zoo. That's really what was tagged when it was built 50 years ago. But we are 50 years old. We're going to be 50. The facilities are in 50-year condition. This is new to me, but I was just recently learned about this graph. We're among the worst facilities of all ratings of all state agencies. So that 50-year-old zoo is really starting to show its wear and tear. A third of the 125 structures are in poor or crisis condition. We have over $78 million of backlog, continues to grow. So obviously this is elevating the risk to our visitors, our staff, and our animals. Unfortunately, it's hard to show this slide, but all of this has impact. And our kinds of jobs, we're 24/7, 365, through all temperatures, outside, inside, when you run a place that has life support for animals and life support for people. But the zoo has one of the worst or the worst incident rate for safety and incidences. And most of them are within our animal care department, which is a lot of people working outside through all types of weather with aging infrastructure. With that said, we are in the governor's recommendation at $4 million. We are very appreciate that and deeply appreciate that $4 million. Those dollars will be used, obviously, for critical needs, specifically around life support systems, which there's a few photos of failed systems that are happening on a pretty regular basis at the zoo. So that's, we do appreciate the governor's recommendation. There is another request that we're asking the committee to consider. A lot of you, I want to thank a lot of everybody. One of the biggest projects we have at the zoo right now and have had for the last few years is to build a new animal hospital, exotic species hospital for Minnesota based at the zoo. We had a request last year that was about $17 million was our request. We were very thankful that we received $11 million. Last year towards that hospital. We were also raised over $12 million privately for that animal hospital, but it was $6 million short. We spent the last year trying to work with the dollars we had, work with our private money, work with the bonding we received, but we were unable to build a standalone hospital with that. So we come back today, we've pivoted. We can't afford to build a new hospital that's standalone. But our old hospital, which is called A Building, it was the first building built on campus. Our approach is we will build a new wing to that A Building hospital. So we will have a new piece of the hospital. But to make this this approach work, we need to restore that old hospital specifically for staff needs. So that is what our $6 million request is asset preservation for the very first building at the zoo. To overall complete this project. To go into a little more detail, we have a head of our animal health programs, Dr. Rivas.
Thank you. Because of the urgent need for a new hospital, we are building the new facility on a smaller footprint, as John indicated, and attaching it to the existing animal hospital in A Building, which some of you may have had the opportunity to tour. This new hospital will accommodate the essential medical functions, but not include space for staff offices, storage, most of our animal holding, or administrative functions. A Building, our oldest building on campus at over 50 years old at this point, must be renovated to support these critical hospital and staffing needs. The $6 million in asset preservation is urgently needed to fund the renovation of A Building's envelope systems, workspaces to remove asbestos, meet code requirements, improve overall safety of the facilities as they stand, and serve the zoo's needs going forward. Without this renovation, the state's investment in the new animal hospital cannot operate as intended or meet the goals that we've outlined, and the zoo cannot provide the level of care for our animals that require or meet industry standards. And just on a bit of a personal note, completing this A Building renovation is not optional. It's essential to ensuring the purpose of the new hospital, but also safety for our staff and animals. I live this every day with my team. It is a really tough environment to be in. We have a lot of risk that we take given the nature of our job. And we do have injuries because our facilities are not up to standard. One of my lead vet nurses had a fall that injured his back and wrist last week during a large animal necropsy or animal autopsy, just trying to manipulate the animal in our older facilities. And on Monday this week, I was actually kicked in the head during a large animal surgery in our own barn because we don't have a lot of the safety facilities established. And 50 years ago, it was fine to kind of cowboy up and do things, but anymore, it's just not how we should be expecting our professionals to be operating.
So co-chairs, committee members, just to recap, we do appreciate the governor's recommendation of the $4 million. We'll use it wisely if received. And then we are requesting additional $6 million to complete that big animal health project. Co-chairs, committee members, open for questions.
Just want to thank you for the presentation today. I don't have anyone. Representative Carroll.
Thank you for your presentation. You have an amazing facility. I always enjoy going there. And so thank you for that. So let's talk about your incidents. What do you mean by that?
Yeah.
And does it affect the public?
Co-chairs, committee members, thank you for that question. 50-year-old campus, like I said, 365, 24/7. When we have incidents at the Minnesota Zoo, we obviously do full investigations of those incidents, and we come down to root causes.
Can you define what an incident means?
It could be a close call with one of our carnivore tigers, which just recently happened, where a tiger was able to reach 6 inches further through a wall that had chain link next to it. Under the investigation, what we found was over the last 50 years that fencing pulled away an extra inch from that cement wall, and just that inch alone allowed the tiger to reach a little bit further through. So it was a close call. We repaired that. We've inspected all of it. It could mean keepers hurting themselves, lack of lighting, lack of ramps, lack of lifts, lacks of animal chutes. All of our animals have to be preventative care. We're doing this right now without the proper modern equipment. We're doing it with old school ways. Those are when the accidents are happening. We do have, this combined with, staffing needs as well. That's not this committee, but another committee. That's what's driving our incident rates. And I think on top of it all is just the nature of the business, the fact that we're doing things 24/7, 365, in all kinds of conditions.
Okay, thank you.
Chair Lee.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Director. So just to be clear, with the $11 million, you said you went forward with the project, and so it's no longer at the entrance of the zoo as in previous rendering, and now it's next to the hospital that we have visited in the past?
Director Frawley.
Co-chairs, committee members, that's correct. We originally envisioned a standalone new facility that had everything we hoped to have in the hospital. But $6 million, we did work for about a year since we last met to try to see if that could work, and we tried to fulfill that original mission. But the square footage cost and the cost of construction and the rising cost of everything is now pivoting us back to a wing of our old hospital. The good news is the new wing will be house all the medical suites, all the modern equipment, all the, those types of things will be brand new. We'll use a building, what we want to hope to renovate, for staff spaces, for meeting spaces. Those are the things what were being cut out of the standalone building. So, and so we think it'll work fine, but we're gonna have to renovate that A building. Thank you.
All right, thank you for the presentation. Thank you again for hosting us last year. We gotta keep moving. Now we move to the Purpose Center for the Arts Education. Welcome to the committee. And on deck will be the Department of Military Affairs. Welcome. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Good morning. Thank you, co-chairs and members of the committee. My name is Allegra Smishek, and I serve as Executive Director of Purpose Center for Arts Education.
Good morning. John Tope, the Finance Director at Purpose Center for Arts Education.
And Betsy Anderson, Communications Director.
Proceed.
I've served as Executive Director for about 18 months and bring more than 20 years of experience in public education across both the metro and greater Minnesota. Purpose provides one of the most impactful educational experiences for both students and educators that I've seen in my career. Because we know it's important to understand our impact locally, we created one-page summaries for each of you representing our impact on your specific Senate district that Jenny Nash has provided. These include the number of educators from your district who have worked with Purpose over the past 2 years, the events they participated in, and their feedback on those experiences in their own words. Because of our strong national reputation, Purpage was selected to participate in the National Scroll-a-thon, a collective art installation celebrating the historic 250th anniversary of our nation's founding. All 50 states and inhabited territories are participating in this project, and Purpich will represent Minnesota. This will be on display at the Kennedy Center in Washington, D.C. later this spring. Purpich Center for Arts Education was founded 40 years ago as a state agency. I will note that our facilities are quite a bit older than that. We're unique because we're both a state agency and we run a public high school. Many of you are likely most familiar with the Purpich Arts High School in Golden Valley, which serves 11th and 12th grade students, but that's only one part of our work. We also operate a statewide arts education resource library that's available to all Minnesota residents, and our professional development and resource programs, which I'll refer to as PDR. The scope of PDR's work is significant. Last year alone, our staff hosted 313 events serving nearly 2,000 educators and administrators across Minnesota. This information is also included in the annual report we provide to the legislature each January. And this map shows the reach of that work. Last year alone, Purpich worked with 275 school districts across all 67 Senate districts. Our arts high school serves 11th and 12th grade students in six arts areas. While the metro area has more than 20 arts-focused schools at elementary, middle, and high school level, there are no comparable options in greater Minnesota. That's why nearly 7 out of 10 students rely on our residential programs. Without it, many students from greater Minnesota would not have access to an arts high school experience. Purpich is not a metro arts school. It is a statewide public access model. Our annual report highlights strong student outcomes, a 100% graduation rate, strong ACT averages, high attendance, and high levels of belonging on the Minnesota Student Survey. Because of these outcomes and others, the Arts School Network recently named Purpich an exemplary school, which is a national designation held for 5 years. Beyond the school year, our campus also supports extensive summer programming, and we host events throughout the year that benefit youth and adults from across Minnesota. As a state agency, Purpich is funded almost entirely by the Minnesota State Legislature. Unlike school districts, we do not have access to traditional funding streams for capital projects. And because of this structure, asset preservation funding is the only way we can address major facility needs. We have no taxation authority. We receive no state aid. And we receive no federal title funding. So asset preservation funding is critical to maintaining our facilities. Last year, we received $1.26 million in asset preservation funding. Thank you. Those funds are being used to upgrade the campus building automation system that manages our HVAC infrastructure. This work modernizes equipment, improves maintenance, and increases heating and cooling efficiency across several campus buildings. We're also replacing aging control components where they will provide the greatest operational return. Our loading dock that you see in the bottom needs to be resurfaced because it's become a safety issue, and we've discovered that there's actually a drainage issue below ground that we need to mitigate so that the tarring retains its normal useful life. This year, we requested $6 million to address two really urgent needs, creating a secure and accessible main entrance and upgrading restrooms to be ADA compliant. We're very grateful that the governor recommended $1.3 million toward this work. These are images of our current main entrance, and it presents both security and accessibility challenges. Visitors must be buzzed into the front entry before providing identification. And our security desk is on the first ground level below. Our main office is on the level above, so guests have to enter, walk up the stairs before we actually are able to do the identification check. For visitors with accessibility needs, the process is even more complicated and requires using an outdated lift before reaching the main elevator. This project would allow us to create a secure, accessible entry point that addresses both concerns. Restrooms on the east side of our administration buildings and dormitories still have their original 1960s fixtures and layouts. As a state agency serving students, families, and staff and visitors from across Minnesota, these spaces need to be brought into ADA compliance. These upgrades are not about expansion. They're about maintaining safe and accessible facilities for students from across Minnesota, as well as educators. Our students come from every region of Minnesota, and they care deeply about their Purpose community and their home communities. These images are about our students supporting Annunciation students at the recent Fletcher Fest and helping them process their grief through art. Like students across our state, Purpose students deserve to learn in facilities that are safe, accessible, and supportive. With your support, we can ensure Purpose continues to provide that environment for students across Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you for the presentation. Seeing no questions, we're going to move on. Representative Allen.
Thank you very much for the presentation. I did have a question on, as far as like funding is concerned. I saw you had about 310 students. I was wondering, what is your per pupil aid? Are you getting per pupil aid, and how much is that?
So Purpose is not funded on a per pupil model, and it never has been. So the Arts High School is just one component of our state agency. So our current funding allocation is $8.6 million. And that supports the Arts High School, but also our Professional Development Resource Program that serves 2,000 educators across the state, and our Resource Library.
Perfect. All right, thank you for the presentation. Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I thank you for your presentation. I just want to ask you an odd question. A couple years ago, we redid the highway there. And I just remember that was a big problem, and the kids were, I remember our former chair, Mary Murphy, and all that, and that, I imagine the tunnel's all done, and the roundabout, and all the work, and I remember kids were kind of running across 55, and dangerous situation. How's that all going? How'd it turn out? Thank you.
Mr. Chair. Yes, Representative, the project is all complete. We had great partners with the City of Golden Valley. I believe it was completed a year and a half ago, if I'm remembering correctly. The tunnel is fully functional and lit, and a very, very safe option, not only for students at Purpose Arts High School, but also citizens of the community.
Thank you.
Representative Perez-Vega.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. I want to say I appreciate, I don't have a question, but I appreciate the opportunities that Purpose's endowments has been for housing students in particularly. It really, really brings a lot of joy to my heart as a performing artist who wishes I had an opportunity as a child to attend such a school in our state. It really showcases not only wanting to bring the importance of performance arts to the metro area, but encouraging those from greater Minnesota to be able to have accessibility of the great arts institutions here in our state, and the capacity for them to not worry to have to travel for that education. So thank you for providing those housing initiatives for these students.
And now I think we're good. Thank you for the presentation. Thank you for coming today. Next up, we have the Minnesota Department of Military Affairs. And then after that, we will have the Department of Natural Resources. If the people from the Department of Natural Resources want to head behind the testifier table so we can keep these transitions to be a little bit quicker, that would be appreciated. Please identify yourself when you're ready and proceed.
Good morning, Chair Frederick, committee members. Thank you for hearing us today. I'm Major General Sean Mankey, the Adjutant General and the Commissioner of the Department of Military Affairs. And Scott?
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Scott Roeder, Executive Director for Department of Military Affairs.
Please proceed.
So, to Mr. Chair, committee members, today we're here to talk about the $6 million in bonding requests asked for our agency through the governor. Mr. Roeder.
Mr. Chair, good morning, committee members. Again, I'm Scott Roeder, the Executive Director for the Department of Military Affairs. I would like to address our number one bonding priority, which is the design funding for a new hangar at the 148th Fighter Wing in Duluth. If you look at the slide in the upper right quadrant of this slide, you'll see a picture of the three existing hangars, which were built in 1958 for the Duluth Air Force Base, which existed on the west side of the Duluth Airport. The three hangars were moved to the east side of the airport to the current 148th Fighter Wing location in the 1980s. The hangars were originally built for Lockheed F-94 aircraft, which is shorter in length and height compared to the F-16 Block 50 aircraft we currently have. Over the years, the three hangars have developed structural and safety issues. Water infiltrates during all seasons, creating electrical safety hazards and challenges working around the aircraft. In the winter, ice forms near the entrances, at the folding doorways, and between the structures. The lightning protection for these buildings is inadequate to protect our aircraft and personnel. These hazards pose risks to our Minnesota National Guard airmen and aircraft. These facilities currently operate under a permanent waiver from the United States Air Force for wingtip clearance because of the inadequate size of the hangars. To the right of that picture is a rendering of the new proposed hangars, which will be designed to not only fit our current F-16 fighters, but large enough space to house an F-35 or a next generation fighter. And those would be to Air Force standards. The design for this project will cost $3.5 million, and if funded, will significantly increase the scoring to compete for federal military construction funding. The 148th Fighter Wing is a significant asset to our community and to our state. It is currently the seventh largest employer in the Duluth area. Its fire department is the only fire department supporting the Duluth International Airport and has mutual aid agreements with all the surrounding communities. The 148th Fighter Wing's Explosive Ordnance Disposal Team provides support to civil authorities throughout the state. Altogether, both the fire department and the Explosive Ordnance Disposal Team provides a total of $3.7 million in mutual aid support to Minnesota annually. Sir?
Yeah, and as the Department of the Air Force recapitalizes the Air National Guard, the 148th Fighter Wing is at a point where in the recapitalization process where the Air Force is starting to look at F-16 recapitalization. The Duluth 148th flies F-16s. And so we want to compete on a metric standpoint. The manning, equipping, training, and maintenance of their aircraft puts them at the top of the pack, but we do need a little bit of help in some of the infrastructure up there to make them more competitive. So this would be an investment in these facilities and hopefully score them higher to land the next version of a fighter aircraft to keep the Duluth 148th in a flying mission. As Mr. Roeder said, the fire department up there and the explosive ordnance detachment provide a tremendous asset to the community up there. If the flying mission would go away and they would be missioned with maybe another mission determined by the Air Force, there's a high probability that the fire department and the EOD would go away because there would not be a need at the wing for those assets. The Air Force is fielding two more layers of F-35s to the Air National Guard, and the decision on those will be made probably in the next 12 to 18 months, and that's why we're asking for this money to try to get this design completed to 35%, and then we would get credit for that as far as facilities in the scoring matrix, the way that we understand it through the Secretary of the Air Force and the Acting Director of the Air National Guard.
Thank you, sir. Next, I'd like to cover the asset preservation. This map depicts our 60 Army facilities locations throughout the state. To the right of the map, you'll see an age breakdown of our facilities. 45% of our facilities are 60-plus years old, and six of them are over 100 years old. This causes significant challenges for many of those facilities, have numerous maintenance issues, are not conducive to current Army operations, and were built at a time when women didn't serve in those units, which means lack of appropriate facilities such as comfort rooms and proper restroom and shower facilities. The National Guard is roughly 40% of the Army's operational force, yet only receives 5% of the federal military construction funding. That means the Minnesota National Guard can expect to receive a military construction funding for a new armory facility once every 10 to 12 years. With 60 current facilities, if the federal funding remains the same, it'll take nearly 600 years to replace all of our facilities. Currently, the only funding source we have to maintain these aging facilities is through our state maintenance appropriation. The Department of Military Affairs receives $10 million annually, of which $1.8 million is designated to the two air wings for their maintenance and repairs, leaving $8.2 million for an annual Army National Guard budget. When you deduct the annual expenses that we have $1.6 million remaining in funds for projects and repairs. Not much money considering the age and number of facilities with today's construction costs. The good news is the state never has to pay 100% of our facility construction and maintenance costs. The Minnesota Army National Guard receives roughly $30 million per year in federal construction and maintenance funding. The blocks below the scale reflect the federal and state share for each type of facility. The readiness centers or armories are a 50-50 split. All the readiness centers that are located at Arden Hills Army Training Site are a 75% federal, 25% state split. And all field maintenance shops, Army aviation support facilities, and major facilities at Camp Ripley Training Center are 100% federally funded. What this means is that every dollar the state appropriates or funds for our readiness centers is matched by the federal government. This $2.5 million asset preservation request, along with the federal government match, really means that we'll get $5 million, which will go a long way in getting after those significant maintenance concerns that we have within the Minnesota Guard. Sir?
Yeah, and I'd just like to close. Thank you for your time today, and I know many of you visited our armory in Cottage Grove earlier this year and saw one of the facilities that we do need to do some maintenance on. And I would like to invite all of you to visit our Rosemont facility, which is a facility that we recently did a renovation on, did a lot of maintenance repairs with both state and federal dollars located in Rosemont, Minnesota. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you. First up, Representative Sexton.
Good morning, General. Good morning, Scott. Wish I was still in uniform, much like I'm sure you do, Scott. Hey, last time you testified, I brought out the risks, so we just need to talk about those. You used the key word, hopefully the investment of $3.5 million actually, gets this project, but hopefully isn't a course of action. That's where my concern is. Now in this role, I've got to look out for all Minnesotans around the state. I would like to ask, though, that if you have a letter or something from the Secretary of the Air Force, as you referenced in slide 4, lower right corner, talking about the transition to F-35s and how you would score, I think, a copy of that letter to all the members would be useful, or whatever the reference that is, because I've not heard of any specific guidance. And just for the members who may not be as familiar with how that works, reallocating aircraft, because they're so expensive, to all the different states involves a lot of our federal congressional members. And so one thing that wasn't brought out is the 133rd here in MSP Airport is going to upgrade from the C-130H to the C-130J. So when we look at how all those assets around the entire United States are spread out, people will say, hey, Minnesota, you just got your aircraft. You may not get F-35s up in Duluth. And in fact, there's quite a few states that have downside. I've actually made a spreadsheet. I won't go through all of it, but Arizona, they had, I need glasses nowadays. MQ-1Bs, which are UAVs, they don't have those any longer. They've been pulled back. MQ-9s, again, UAVs were assigned in Arkansas and replaced the F-16s. In California, they lost their KC-135s, which is much like a 707, and then were replaced with MQ-1s. Coming down the list, in Idaho, they actually inactivated a C-130 unit. In the other unit in Idaho, they actually, because the A-10 is going to be sent to the boneyard, yeah, they are transitioning to the F-16. So that's my example of one aircraft unit went away, and the other aircraft unit was upgraded. And this goes on and on to many of the states throughout the nation. In fact, many states, in the past, we used to have at least two flying units per state. Many states are down to one flying unit. So this is a risky investment using bonding dollars. We want to be very transparent about that. You know, thank you, Mr. Lee. It was late when I asked the question. But MPCA just came out with a report in January 2026 that shows that we have 468 wastewater projects in Minnesota for a total of $2.66 billion. There is no risk for us investing in our own wastewater facilities. There is a risk here, and I would suggest, General, that you come back to the military committee and put the $3.5 million in that request and not in bonding, because bonding is the only way we can address clean water and drinking water here in the state of Minnesota. That's my question.
Would either of you like to respond to that briefly?
Mr. Chair. Yeah, Representative Sexton, appreciate your time, appreciate your comments, and obviously I appreciate everything that you've just said. You know, the avenue that we are using is where we're at right now. And I can tell you that I cannot refute that the Air Force has made some decisions to draw down some of their flying missions. And I 100% agree with what Representative Sexton has said that. However, you know, the people told me when I came in the job that the 133rd, literally my first week on the job, they said, hey, General Mankey, how would you like to have a different mission for the 133rd? And I talked with the governor, and I said respectfully, we would like to preserve a flying mission for the 133rd. And fortunately, we were successful in transitioning them from the H models to the J models. And I can tell you, there is risk. I think there's risk in everything that we do. I'm trying to mitigate the risk to keep an operational flying mission in Duluth, Minnesota, in the 148th Fighter Wing. They've been successful for countless years. The uniqueness of the mission that they perform federally makes them one of two fighter wings in the Air National Guard that does this mission, as well as the success for their manning, equipping, readiness, and the ability that they do to operate and how they've performed on some of their inspections. Now, we can certainly continue to look for other funding resources, but I would ask that the committee consider using bonding money for this so that we can get after this problem set. Thank
you. Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Chair Frederick. Thank you both for your presentation. Thank you for your service. My question is about the asset preservation. Do you have a list of the request, how you would break down that request? And could you share a little bit more about how you prioritize beyond age? Because clearly the amount you're asking for won't get you everywhere, but it'd be nice to know more about the detail. Thank you.
Director.
Mr. Chair, Representative. Yes, so that $2.5 million, obviously the $5 million construction costs are extremely expensive nowadays. So even $5 million doesn't really go very far. The intended use right now, we do have projects. Our facility management office has all sorts of projects that are on the shelf ready to go for these types of funding pieces. The current plan for this money would go to the Army Aviation Support Facility number 1, which is down in St. Paul. That is one of the facilities I listed in here as 100% federal funding, but it does have an armory section that's attached to it that is a 75-25 split. So this would give us an opportunity to make that, instead of $5 million, almost a $7 million batch project. It would allow us to complete the renovations of that facility and set that one up for success in the future. That is a facility that the Adjutant General has said he's going to keep in St. Paul and not divest of that armory at any time in the future. So,
Representative Ryer? No. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and General. We enjoyed visiting up in Duluth.
You know, and that seems like a very long time ago. Our state's been through a lot since that time. And our country's going through a lot right now. We're in an undeclared war. So what does that mean? What does that mean for Duluth when we are engaged with a combat apparently around the world? What does that mean for the Duluth base? What does that mean in the future?
General?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, hey, appreciate the question. Thank you. You know, as has been publicly reported, we have over 200 service members deployed to the central area, CENTCOM area of operations. Some of those members are from the 148th Fighter Wing. We continue to perform missions in the state of Minnesota, both at the state level. You know, we had over 600 soldiers on state active duty since the beginning of the year. We continually deploy service members, both airmen and soldiers, for our federal mission. And then we do things locally as well. So the impacts right now to the state of Minnesota and our National Guard are not that substantial at the moment. But, you know, we always train for our federal mission. You know, and my charter as the Adjutant General is to train, man, and equip our soldiers and airmen. And I take that very seriously. So that when our soldiers go out the door to do whatever is asked to do, we ask them to do either at the state level or at the federal level, I have confidence that they're trained. I can look at the family members that they leave behind and say, hey, your service members trained. They have the best possible equipment that we can give them. And they're resourced properly to do the training here in the state of Minnesota, as well as when they deploy to do their federal mission. I would hate to speculate on what this means for the future employment of our National Guard, but I'm charged with making sure that if they are asked to go do something, and we as a state owe it to our National Guard to make sure that we train them, we properly man them, so our recruiting is doing very well. And the Army National Guard, we're sitting at 107% strength. So for every 100 slots, I have 107 soldiers to fill those slots. And on the Air National Guard, we're at 102 to 103% strength. So for every, again, for every 100 slots that we have 102 or 103 people to do that. And we prioritize that, we emphasize that. We don't have a problem with that here in the state of Minnesota, where there's other regions of the country that struggle a little bit more with that. And I think that's part of that is because the state of Minnesota embraces them, thanks them for their service, and we're a community-based organization. So we're part of the communities. We work here, we live here, and we serve here, if that answers your question.
All right. Representative Sexton.
No further questions.
Oh, sorry. Representative Scrappa.
Thank you, Chair. Kind of in that same direction, I have a friend from the 148th that's over there right now. We also protect the border. Not that you can't protect it from Missouri, but it's a lot faster when you take off from Duluth if the bad guys are coming. And I have to, in Fargo, I believe that is not anymore. The Happy Hooligans, is that who they were, I believe? So strategically, I'm very partial to Duluth because I've been to deployments where everyone is together, families, and it all gets broken down, and you watch everyone, and you watch these people, and your training and the process, the military process. I was a member of the National Guard or Army Reserves National Guard for 9 years, and I understand. I was fortunate. I never had to be deployed. I made that window that no one ever went. But I watch and I go to these to see the type of training, the type of people. It's still the same. And when I hear we're going to switch wings or different types of aircraft, there has to be somewhere in that chain of command that knows that the 148th has been everywhere. I mean, I don't know what campaign we haven't been at. So if we show up and we have a recruitment of 102, 107, whatever it is, percent, that has to weigh in on when you're looking at trying to, look, we have people, we're active, they're good, they win awards. Everyone always been, it has to come into play. And if it does, if there's any way we can help, I'm partial to this, so I'm all behind it. I just hope that we use all of our assets to keep those assets here. Thank you, Chair. More of a statement.
Thank you for that. Any final thoughts?
Mr. Chair, I thank the committee for their time. I thank the people of Minnesota for all the support that they continue to give the Minnesota National Guard, both our airmen and our soldiers. And I look forward to any other further questions that you have. Please get them to us, and we'll be happy to address them or meet you individually. Thank you.
Thank you both for the presentation. Now we'll move to the Minnesota DNR. And on deck is Minnesota State. If you'd like to move behind the testifier table, please. Please introduce yourself when you're ready and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Frederick, co-chairs, members of the committee. My name is Sarah Stroman, and I have the honor of serving as Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources, and with me is Samantha Minkler, the DNR's Capital Asset Manager. We are pleased to be here to present the Governor's 2026 Infrastructure Proposal for the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources, as well as a brief update on the 2025 Natural Resource Asset Preservation. We'd like to start with just a brief reminder about the capital assets that are managed by DNR. DNR manages and maintains a vast array of public land and infrastructure on behalf of Minnesotans, providing countless benefits to our state. These assets not only support our agency mission, they serve Minnesotans and are part of the fabric of communities all across Minnesota. Many of the assets are highly visible and directly experienced by Minnesotans, and caring for these assets requires a systematic and comprehensive approach. DNR assets are, in addition to being numerous, they are diverse and unlike many state assets. This slide depicts the types of assets and the numbers of each of them. I think it's important to remember that these assets represent more than just built or natural things. They represent experiences for Minnesotans. For example, we might be talking about the state park campground or camper cabin, where Minnesotans spend time with their family and friends around a fire, sleep under the stars and in the fresh air, and relax after doing their favorite outdoor activities. We might be talking about the public fishing pier, where a child catches their first fish, and the fish hatchery, where that fish was raised for stocking. We might be talking about the native prairie that supports pheasants, songbirds, and pollinators while improving water quality and capturing carbon. We might be talking about DNR shops and storage buildings where equipment is maintained, tools are and parts are stored, and new signs are prepped for installation, and many, many more things. In addition to the diverse types of assets, our assets are extensive and geographically dispersed across all 87 counties and 5.6 million acres of land. Our built assets have a current replacement value of $4.36 billion. And stewardship of these assets, as I said, requires ongoing repair, renovation, and replacement. As you've also heard from us every year, we have a growing deferred maintenance challenge. That number and variety, condition, and age of DNR facilities all contribute to a significant capital need for asset preservation. As you'll see in this graph, our asset preservation appropriation, shown by the blue line at the bottom, have been far short of what is needed to address that deferred maintenance backlog, shown by the green bars, which have been increasing over time. I do want to address what we are doing to address this challenge and that widening gap. Obviously, we are here asking for investment through capital investment. We also recognize that additional strategies are needed to realistically make sure that we are managing those assets for the services that Minnesotans expect. So some of the other things we are doing is planning around historic building asset management. We know that our historic buildings are highly valued by the public, yet they are some of the most expensive to operate and maintain. So by doing a plan, we believe we can identify, evaluate, and prioritize strategies for addressing the significant investment needs associated with historic structures. We're also putting more emphasis on leasing opportunities when DNR offices and storage buildings are in poor condition and must be significantly refurbished or reaching the end of their life. And then lastly, we are also looking at divestment planning, and we have a list of priority divestments, and we do complete divestments as funding allows us to do so. We very much appreciate the appropriations that we do receive, and we are putting those investments to great use. For example, in 2025, we spent nearly $9.6 million in natural resources asset preservation from appropriations spanning from 2018, 19, 20, 23, and 25. Our 2025 NRAP report was provided to the committee, and it lists the specific projects with expenditures in 2025, and some of the examples are depicted on this slide. I do want to note that the project spending you see on each line in that report does not represent the full project costs, as many projects are completed across multiple calendar years. While these projects will decrease deferred maintenance for each specific asset, without consistent and adequate funding, our total deferred maintenance will continue to trend upwards. So I want to talk a little bit about more about the 2025 NRAP appropriation next. This slide presents the overview of the 2025 NRAP allocation. A detailed spreadsheet with specific projects was included in your committee packet. Hopefully this allocation looks familiar to all of you, because we did start with a $35 million list provided to the committee during the 2025 session. We then adjusted that list to match the actual appropriation, to update project costs and to update it based on current agency priorities, as well as to include a construction contingency. Also, just think it's important to note kind of the typical project funding cycle and life cycle for bond-funded projects, so you get a sense of our pace of spending of capital investment dollars. When we receive a bonding appropriation from the legislature, we go through the following steps. Obviously, that appropriation is received. We then develop a final allocation plan, such as the one we just described. Our projects are designed. We have to go through permitting, other natural and cultural resource reviews. Then there's bidding, and then there is construction. So what that means is the majority of the spending related to infrastructure projects occurs in year 3 or 4 following the appropriation, as the initial steps don't occupy as much funding. There are a number of other factors that also influence the timing of infrastructure projects, including the complexity of project design, the complexity and timing of those resource reviews, sequencing of projects to improve bid prices, and the availability of contractors. So we will move next to our 2026 proposal. In developing our 2026 proposal, we use our standardized framework based on our 10-year capital asset need report, which Sam is holding up here. We are continually assessing our assets to identify our need, and our deferred maintenance need is too large to address it all at once. So our request does reflect this 10-year approach. We also work across DNR programs and disciplines to identify the highest priority renewal and replacement projects, as well as new investments, based on enterprise and agency strategic direction and priorities. Given the size and scope of DNR's custodial responsibilities, it is necessary to strike a balance between system-wide and programmatic investments and targeted or project investments. To adequately care for this set of diverse and unique assets and to address the growing needs, we need to operate primarily in that programmatic rather than project-by-project framework. You have heard this before. Why do we do this? Well, we have over 2,800 buildings with 30,000 building components. We obviously can't be here talking about every roof, every HVAC system, every road mile, those kinds of things. It also allows us to operate more efficiently. If one project gets held up, we can quickly pivot to another project that is ready to go and coordinate projects to make sure that we are maximizing use of the dollars and minimizing disruption. We're also able to prioritize system-wide, not just for one location, not just one part of the state, or not just for one type of assets or one division. And then we also need flexibility to address not only that visible infrastructure, but our invisible infrastructure. We have a lot of assets that are integral to serving the public, but are not always obvious. For example, the wastewater systems that we operate, trail culverts, and the like. We do also need to focus attention on specific resources or specific projects to meet the changing needs of Minnesotans and to advance specific strategic objectives. So, for example, accessibility is a key component of our programmatic natural resource asset preservation. As facilities age, as we replace them, we, of course, meet accessibility needs. You'll also see in our request, though, a targeted investment focused on accessibility, which allows us to make more targeted, comprehensive accessibility upgrades at a few specific areas in order to create a comprehensive experience overall for Minnesotans. And then our community assistant grant programs are really important for supporting local needs. So in 2026, our natural resources asset preservation, or NRAP, remains our top capital asset investment priority. And the governor has proposed $30 million for repair, renovation, or replacement of degraded or failing infrastructure. Our NRAP infrastructure categories include buildings and site infrastructure, water and wastewater systems, roads, trails, bridges, public water accesses, campsites, including group camps, shower buildings, day use areas, and vault toilets, fish hatcheries, and water control structures. These asset preservation investments ensure that our infrastructure is safe, that it is functional for the public, that it supports conservation of Minnesota's natural resources, and preserves the state's investment in its capital assets. And as I said, we do consider design factors such as accessibility, energy efficiency, and climate resilience in this work. The photos here demonstrate different types of asset preservation needs across the state. For example, the top left photo is the Brightsdale Footbridge in the R.J. Doar State Forest. This bridge is currently closed for safety reasons. You can probably see those are very evident as the abutments are failing and sliding down the hillside. This bridge clearly is in need of replacement. At the top right, you'll see an in-progress photo of the Forestville Campground septic field replacement. This is the drain field that services the campground shower building. It was at the end of its useful life and needed replacement. This project is now complete, but I think a good example of if this system is not operational, that campground's usefulness to the public is not realized. And at the bottom center, that picture is of a cold storage pole barn at Lac du Parle WMA that stores tractors and other essential equipment. This building suffered severe storm damage in 2023, and due to the damage to the roof and the loss of structural integrity, the building was replaced in 2025. So these are just a few examples of DNR's unique asset preservation needs and the diversity of those needs. And I think HOPE helped illustrate how Minnesotans rely on this infrastructure for recreation, such as hunting, fishing, boating, camping, hiking, and other pursuits, as well as access to homes and cabins via roadways, as well as safety and wildfire response. Next, the governor proposes $3 million for betterment of buildings. In 2026, our top priorities for funding for this program are to design a new St. Paul fish hatchery, to replace or enhance high-priority DNR office and storage facilities, to complete construction of a new seed extractory, packing house, and cooler, as well as office expansion and remodel at the Bordura State Forest Nursery, and to construct new or significantly modernized visitor centers, picnic shelters, trail centers, and other state park infrastructure. Just want to note that betterment is an important complement to our asset preservation funding. While asset preservation addresses the backlog of deferred maintenance that affects safety, usability, and effectiveness of DNR managed facilities and infrastructure, betterment funding allows for substantial improvement to, or addition to, or replacement of buildings that fail to meet current needs or have reached the end of their useful life. These programs together, both the natural resources asset preservation and betterment together, are critical to address our substantial infrastructure needs. Capital funding for public lands is needed to improve and conserve Minnesota's natural heritage, enrich public outdoor recreational opportunities, and provide for sustainable commercial uses of natural resources. Public lands also provide an opportunity for enhanced carbon sequestration and ecosystem resilience to address climate change, and the governor proposes $2 million for acquisition and betterment of public lands. And an appropriation of $2 million would most likely fund reforestation on public lands. DNR also helps keep Minnesotans safe in a variety of ways, and capital funding is needed to support these efforts. The governor's proposal includes three proposals related to public safety. These include one targeted investment that brings focused attention and resources to wildfire and emergency response at the Brainerd Airport, as well as two community investments that fund dam safety and flood hazard mitigation grants. Critical infrastructure upgrades to modernize wildfire and emergency operations center at the Brainerd Regional Airport. I think, as many of you know, our aviation units are vital to the state's wildfire and emergency response operations. Our aviation teams respond to wildfires, floods, windstorms, and winter storm damage on state-administered lands across Minnesota. They also provide critical initial attack and surveillance for wildfire suppression, as well as law enforcement activities, search and rescue, and transport of medical and first responder personnel. This $5 million request includes facilities to accommodate daily fire briefings, emergency dispatch, crew readiness, and pilot rest areas, includes an air tanker loading facility, as well as emergency equipment storage. These improvements will vastly enhance efficiency, coordination, and the effectiveness of emergency response, as well as natural resource management. Dam safety funding is essential to maintain the structural integrity of dams, prevent public safety hazards, and maintain water levels on rivers and lakes. Funding is allocated to projects per the dam safety priority list, and the current highest priority on that list is the dam removal at the Rapidan Dam. Flood hazard mitigation is the last public safety proposal. It provides for flood risk reduction, and it's critical in the face of a changing climate. We currently have $213 million in project applications from cities, counties, watershed districts, and other public entities. $213 million awaiting funding. This request will help support the highest priorities of those projects based on the 9 funding considerations that are detailed in state statute. The investments that have been made previously have resulted in a more flood-resilient state and in significantly reduced emergency flood response, reduced economic impact from those events, and reduced recovery costs. However, even with that progress, we know we still have needs remaining. I know you hear from many folks in your districts on that. I just will note, finally, that project priorities are based on a competitive application process consistent with the procedures outlined in Minnesota Statutes 103F.161. And then, finally, outdoor recreation and accessibility go hand in hand and are essential to better serving Minnesotans. We are requesting $2 million to continue our efforts to develop comprehensive accessibility at state parks, wildlife management areas, and aquatic management areas. And again, our goal here is not simply to meet code, it's to create spaces and environments that are welcoming and open to all. We work closely with the Minnesota Council on Disability in these projects. And just one example I'd like to share, maybe some of you have had an opportunity to visit the recently redone William O'Brien State Park. That project was a comprehensive accessibility effort that was completed just last year, and it really, I think, represents the goal of what we're trying to do here of make all of the park experience accessible, not only to people with mobility limitations, but their friends and family, so they can enjoy the experience together. And then last but not least, our $1 million request for local and regional trail grant programs, which is really important to allow us to partner with local communities to acquire land and develop parks and trails that help create a network of close-to-home recreation facilities. In summary, the governor's 2026 bonding proposal for the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources will help us maintain and preserve the essential natural resources infrastructure that benefits Minnesotans across the state. Our proposal focuses on taking care of what we have while advancing strategic priorities that serve both current and future generations. We appreciate the opportunity to be here today, and we're happy to take any questions. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Commissioner. I'm going to start with a question. In 2025, when we were negotiating the bonding bill, we had reached out to you regarding the flood hazard mitigation program. And as we're this committee, as we're working with our Senate partners, developing how much money we can afford to put to that program, we had requested the list of projects. And that way, if we cannot make the full ask, we want to fund as many as we can, but be intentional about getting enough to cover the projects that were on the top of the list. We made decisions based off the list that was provided to this committee and to the negotiating team. And then after that bill was passed, the projects that were on the top of that list, based on the information we were provided, were not the projects that were funded. Can you explain to me and explain to the committee what happened there?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm happy to. And I did have a conversation with Co-Chair Lee about this and Chair Pappas in the Senate. As I said, in talking about the flood hazard mitigation grant, there are criteria that are laid out in statute, and per statute, that is a competitive grant program. So the list that we provide is a list of the highest priorities as we know them at the time you request the list. When the appropriation is made, then again, per the statute, we open up that competitive grant program and we reassess those needs based on the applications received. And so we are bound by that competitive grant program as laid out in statute, and so we do our best to provide you the list of priorities as we know them, but that does not negate the fact that the flood hazard mitigation program is a competitive grant program.
Representative Scraba.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. It's obvious we don't have enough time, so I'm going to try to concentrate what I have. You have asset preservation, then you have money for public water accesses. One of them that you're doing now in my district, you're doing several in the district I represent. We had public hearings, public meetings. I was at them. There was zero people in support of the plan that you guys wanted to do. Still going through. Johnny bar the door, we're right, you're wrong. And the public, these are people that live there. I was like so disappointed. And I've been back and forth, met with Bob, met with everyone. And the public is still asking me, is this really still going to happen? I'm like, yeah, this is the way government works. They don't care about you. They just care about their program and spending their money. And that's my gripe. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that. One of the issues that I have is in your budget, you have all the money you want from capital investments, but where's the money coming from for LCCMR, from different other funding agencies? Is it matching? Because some of this stuff, I also sit on LCCMR, and I've seen it in there. I'm not going to bridge all of them, but my experience, the agency is so big. I commend you for keeping yourself together. I get my mind blown just trying to keep track of all the different things that you have to manage and the different people and the issues. I get called literally daily on DNR issues, you know, and I have to figure out how to talk to these people saying it's, I'm not going to get an answer right now, okay? Whether it's logging, whether it's road building, whether it's gravel pit, whether it's grooming, I go down the list every day. But how do we, from this standpoint, giving the money for these projects? You talked about your cabins at the state park, you know, different state parks. I've always been kind of we're building cabins so people can pay $10 a night to stay in. Yet the resort on the lake is charging $50, and he can't get anyone to stay at their cabin. You know, and we're direct competition, and we're giving the money for that. I get it. Some people can't afford $50. This $10 is better. I'm with that. I get that part. But it's kind of different. I'm going to try to just keep it real simple. Where do the matching monies from the other eight piles of money meet these? And do we get to see that somewhere?
Commissioner.
Thank you, Chair.
Mr. Chair, Representative Scraba, lots of great questions. I'll try to cover them all and comments. One is, I absolutely hear you. I have no doubt you hear from constituents all the time on DNR issues. The reality is Minnesotans love their natural resources. There isn't a part of the state that doesn't contain unique and amazing natural resources. So we have a very large footprint in the state, both in terms of what's available and the passion around it. And so, you know, we do our best to interact with people. We do our best to support you in those interactions. And that includes, you know, trying to get public input and listening to that public input, whether that is a public water access project or others. We also have a fiscal responsibility to make sure that that infrastructure is working within our legal constructs, and I know we can talk about that project later on. We do have a strategy to how we use different funds and the way we invest them to knit together, you know, the needs we have across. So, for example, we're here asking for bonding dollars for our capital assets. We also do have some LCCMR dollars that support trail work, for example. Neither of those sources together meets the total need, but we can use them together strategically to meet the highest priority needs. We have legacy dollars, too, that do some capital investment. Some of those dollars are also used for other elements of what creates the experience. So, you know, staffing is also a really important part of a state park experience. I always say you can build a really lovely new bathroom building if you don't have the staff to clean it. That investment is not going to be right as was intended. So all of those things, the programming we do at parks, the land management to make sure if you are in one of our WMAs hunting, there is wildlife there. There is habitat that supports wildlife for that experience. So that is how we think about what is the experience we are trying to create and what are the array of funding sources and how can we strategically layer them, not redundant, but how do we strategically layer them to maximize the outcome? And so I know we do have some additional written information on how we use those that we could certainly provide to the committee. I think the last thing I'll just say in terms of the issue you noted with potential competition with resorts or private entities, that is not our goal. We provide a different kind of camper experience than the resorts do. I know Assistant Commissioner Meyer was just meeting with the resorts yesterday. That is a relationship we really value. We believe we complement each other to provide those outdoor experiences and connections to nature that Minnesotans are looking for. So we try to build our experiences differently than what is available in the private sector as well.
All right, members, we have Allen, Lilly, Ryer, Sexton, and Hansen to go, and possibly two presentations. So if we can keep our questions as concise as possible, we can get both presentations in still. So any follow-up, Representative Scraba?
In the sake of time, I'll
appreciate that. Representative Allen.
Thank you, Chair Frederick. I wanted just to go back real briefly to slide 5, deferred maintenance challenge in your strategic solutions. You were talking about, I liked some of what I was seeing there. I was just wondering if you could dive in a little bit more into the divestment portion of it and what you specifically were referencing there.
Commissioner.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Allen. So we recognize that there will be some buildings that their condition is sort of beyond and we will not have the funding. So whether it's land we can divest or buildings that we can divest that just don't meet a priority of furthering our mission anymore. So for example, there was a building at Lindbergh State Park near Little Falls that we recently took down, and we replaced it with some interpretive signage. It was a, you know, more historic building, and so we can talk about what was there, but it was not a building after roofs cave in, for example, that made sense to invest in. So obviously we didn't divest of the land in that case, but we divested and demolished of the building. In some cases, it may be a land divestment, which goes through our strategic land asset management then.
Representative Allen.
Quick follow-up or comment, I guess. Of all the agencies we have in the state of Minnesota, Commissioner, respectfully, you sit on the only agency that has an asset that is continually increasing in value, specifically on ground that has been donated to you and your agency as far as like agriculture ground. It directly competes with farmers, young farmers that are trying to get established, and I would hope that would be considered as part of your divestment strategy, is possibly liquidating some of that land that's out there so it can go back into the tax rolls. We can get young farmers started on this ground and get things going again. It's at $10,000 an acre. You'd have to sell 3,300 acres approximately in order to be able to cover your request in front of us right now. So I would hope that would be one of those strategies you would consider doing. So thank you.
Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner. I appreciate your focuses on the betterment of buildings, and I was glad to tour the St. Paul facility. I hadn't actually been there my whole life, and I would hope that you would consider fixing that up, like the one down in down by Rick Hansen's farm with the trout. I would really I really question the focus. I have a couple maybe negative things to say, but the focus on trout, I think, is a little misaligned. I would bet that 99% of the fisher people in Minnesota are not fishing trout, and down there we have all these beautiful, it's such a beautiful place, and it's just you know, there's like trophy sized trout that you could actually take out and put up on your wall if you were so inclined. But I would just like us to see us focus on other types of fish, because I think 99% of the Minnesotans are fishing other things. I was looking at your allegation last year on the 25, and it just, there's really, and I get it, you know, most of your properties are in greater Minnesota, but there's really nothing in the metro. And I think, and I really love tourism and supporting greater Minnesota, but the reality is most people start local and in the metro. And to me, I think of my area and what I notice, you know, there's 20 people fishing on a fishing pier that is a lake that I live near. And, you know, or on the shorelines, another 20. And, you know, ideally those folks would eventually go out. So that's why I speak to the fish. I think you're focused on the wrong fish. I think you need to get, you know, and then more people, you know, by stocking and the Metro Lakes. I know you're, you raise some star fisher people in your own family, and I know you live in the West Metro. I don't know much about the West Metro, but I imagine it's the same. You know, stocking our Metro Lakes is something that the DNR could really focus on and do good, and that would help, I think, ultimately tourism, because people are more inclined then to go out and fish and camp and do all these other things. I don't really see any trail work in the metro. I don't know, like, I know you live in the West Metro, but the East Metro, the only like DNR trail that I'm aware of, like, is Browns Creek and Gateway, and the pressure is incredible on these trails. Like, it's really popular, and I would imagine that the Gateway Trail and Browns Creek matches any number of any of your greater state parks, and maybe I'm wrong, but I mean, the pressure is incredible. But but I don't see any investment. I saw like $1 million in parks and trails, and I know you get other pots of money. I get that. I've been here a while. You know, I was lucky enough to be chair of Legacy, so I know, but I don't see that here, and it's frustrating for me that you're not focusing on the metro. I know Three Rivers and the West Metro, you know, does, you know, great programs, Minneapolis, you know, the St. Paul system, others, but I don't see DNR doing anything in the metro, and I just, it's really, it's sad to me because, you know, a lot of people that are less fortunate, and maybe than myself even, to live on water, you know, can't experience it, so and we want people to be able to affordably get on and enjoy the assets of Minnesota, and I think that ultimately helps them to go out and enjoy greater Minnesota parks and trails as well. So anyways, I guess, you know, I'm getting to the end of my career at some point here, but it's just frustrating that we just continue to not focus on where the people are and affordability, and the DNR, I think, could just really do amazing work working with the people, you know, like stocking and trail work in the metro. That's it. Thank you.
Brief response.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lilly, I appreciate that, and maybe we can follow up either with you directly offline or with the committee. I think when you look at all of our funding sources, you will find we are doing quite a bit of work in the metro, from creating more shore fishing opportunities, the stocking work we're doing, public water access work we're doing, trail work we're doing. I mentioned the comprehensive updates at William O'Brien State Park. We just acquired the Keystone Woods Wildlife Management Area in Washington County. And the St. Paul Hatchery is obviously one of our next priorities, in addition to not only the Crystal Springs Trout Hatchery, but we are also comprehensively upgrading the Waterville Hatchery, which is a cool water fish hatchery, or warm water fish hatchery, and it produces a lot of the walleye that get stocked across the state. So we are trying to balance, and you know, we'd love to provide more information on metro focused projects from all funding sources, but hear your point.
Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Commissioner. I'd like to talk here a little bit more about the accessibility fund. You have $2 million there. I'm curious what it would take to have basic accessibility, you know, at the level that you would envision, and how, what kind of roadmap you have in your mind for progress over the years to come.
Commissioner.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Ryer, I can't give you a dollar amount for what's the total amount to achieve the level of accessibility we want to achieve. And partly that's because the, as I said, sort of the basic code compliance is built into our natural resource asset preservation. As we upgrade, we do that. The comprehensive nature, we know we aren't going to be able to do every single place, but we're picking specific sites like William O'Brien, and we're using not only bonding, but some of our Get Outdoor, Get Out More dollars, or Modernize Outdoor Recreation Experiences, providing track chair equipment across state parks, providing accessible hunting blinds at WMAs. And so we're really focused on kind of that opportunity to create more comprehensive experiences at certain sites than kind of sprinkling across the entire system. We think the public is better served in that way.
Any follow-up? Representative Sexton.
My question relates back to slide 13. In spite of representing southern Minnesota, I have an incredible number of people who appear to own land in northern Minnesota, and they have a lot of questions for me. Could you prepare like a five-year look back of your land acquisition, maybe a spreadsheet much like you've already provided, but show the location, the cost, including donated land, and any plans for future improvements of that property?
Mr. Chair, Representative Sexton, yes, we can provide more information on our land acquisition or our land portfolio.
Thank you.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and you know, I think it's important to get on the record that it is not appropriate to match LCCMR money with bonding money. It is not appropriate to be putting state dollars together and not have any local match for projects. And that has been what has been occurring for years. And an abuse of power becomes an entitlement. And that's what's happened. Entitlement. Entitled to the money. And that's why, Representative Willie, we don't get the money in the metro. That's what's happened. It's not appropriate. I have a question. I hope the general fund, the $100 million that we gave you, is not going to match bonding money either. It should be local money. It's okay if you have Trail A and Trail B. One of them gets LCCMR, one of them gets general fund, one of them gets bonding. But you can't blend that money together to pay for this stuff. It's not supposed to happen. But it has been. It's been accepted. And then when you say something about, oh my God, you're picking on us. I'd like to know if you can do a community tree planting program with $5 or $10 million to deal with emerald ash borer and replacement trees in the next year.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, I have no doubt we can do a community tree planting program. We can certainly have a discussion about the amount and how quickly we think we could get that out the door and communities could spend it. As you know, I hope the committee knows, we did this last year release the largest RFP ever, I believe, in terms of the amount of dollars between bonding and other dollars that we had for communities to do tree work. So we are very appreciative of that, and I know the communities are as well.
Follow up. Representative Perez Vega.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Hansen. You kind of circled around the questions as far as even with Representative Lilly on the local impact, the contributions of outreach to something that I'm very passionate about is our youth, and also the connections of, I think I mentioned this when we visited in the fall, where are the partnerships of solidarity with our tribal governments as well, where a lot of these projects are having, but in connectivity to also the metro area? What are the outreaches that are connected to within our districts and the local capacities? I live off the river. It wasn't too far to see how effective our environment has been destroyed when we think about just 30 years ago when I would ride my bike and wish that there's opportunities to be included into the decision making, because I think our youth are really asking for that. Mm-hmm. They want to be connected to the natural resources. They want to express the need for the leadership to be paying attention to their future. And I'm a little kind of sitting here in the role of representing those youth to say, there's not really much coming forth other than, oh, we do these outreach surveys, we do these connected projects, but, you know, where are the district councils? Where are the city's collaborative efforts, the county's collaborative efforts that are the direct access to those children in the environment? And so, you know, I think about tribal government. I want to see where the opportunities have advanced for those joint partnerships, especially since the federal funds have been crunched out, and also the contributions of where this hits my district directly in the capital city, where you're requesting millions of dollars, but like my colleagues here said, we never get to see it. And our environmental justices are just as predominantly valued as our greater Minnesota partnerships. No questions.
Any response to that, Commissioner Hill? Anything you'd like to say?
Mr. Chair and Representative, maybe we could have a conversation offline about our work with tribes and our work with youth, and would love to hear more about your ideas as well, in addition to what we're doing. So would welcome that conversation.
Okay, with that, I don't believe we have any further questions for you. Thank you for coming, and thank you for the presentation.
Thank you very much for having us.
So we are going to pivot, and we are going to have both presentations from the universities at a following date. I would like to thank the representatives from Minnesota State and the U of M for being here today. Apologies that the discussion went long. I'm looking forward to having that conversation in the future. And with that, members, our next meeting will be on Tuesday, March 10th. This meeting is adjourned.